I'd like to call this meeting to order. It is approximately 1:33 p.m. on Tuesday, February 7th. President and Representative
Ortiz, Representative Pruitt, Representative Wilson, Vice Co-Chair Seaton, Co-Chair Foster, Representative Tilton, Representative Guttenberg, and Representative Thompson. And before we start, I'll remind everybody about their cell phones. And on today's schedule, we're going to take up amendments to HB 23, insurance for dependents of deceased police and firefighters. But before we do that, we go to our regular schedule. I'd like to ask the committee to entertain a motion delegating to Representative Foster and myself the authority to introduce bills in the name of the committee. And Representative Guerra has joined us as well. Representative Foster.
Thank you, Co-Chair Seaton. I move and ask unanimous consent that Representative Seaton and Representative Foster, the chairs of the House Finance Committee, be delegated the duties and responsibilities in AS24.08.060A during regular and special sessions of the 30th Alaska State Legislature, and this delegation remains in effect until withdrawn by the committee.
Object.
Object.
There's an objection. Representative Wilson, would you like to speak to your objection?
Absolutely. I think we're in different times where there are a lot of different options when we're especially talking about the budget, and to be putting out not knowing what they are. It would be one thing if you were coming to us and asking us about a specific bill that we could discuss to see whether or not the majority of us would be in favor of that bill or not, but you're asking us that any bill that the co-chairs want to put together almost seems like it's supportive of the whole committee. I know you could do that right now. That is within your power to do. But I think if people have an idea and want to move it forward, that at this time, underneath the kind of budget restraints that we're at, that it would be better that it came out as an individual legislative bill versus from a committee.
Representative, I think, Pruitt and then Guerra.
Yeah, thank you. No, Mr. Chair, I think when you put a bill out and it's from the whole committee, there's a both a mindset within the building and a mindset outside of the building that is, for the most part, agreed on by the committee. Now, that's not always the case, and I recognize in the past that how it hasn't always been the case. But I also didn't always agree with them being put out by committees, even when I found myself in the majority. I do recognize that there's a certain point in time in the next session when the only opportunity to offer up bills would be via committee. And I think it's worth a discussion at that point in time, asking whether or not the committee would go forward. Of course, it's your right at that point in time to go forward even without us. But I think this blanket putting something out there that would almost have the assumption from an individual like myself that I would agree with whatever may come out, I can't not say anything or not object to that. I think you and I could have an honest look at, honest conversation with each other as we've had in the past, and we could recognize that we don't always agree eye to eye on certain things, and that's okay. I'm fine with that. But at the same time, I don't necessarily feel that that I should be kind of lumped in with whatever may personally come out. And so with that, that's where the objection comes from. Thank you for allowing me to speak to it, Mr. Chair.
Representative Guerra.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I feel like the world's gone topsy-turvy. For over a decade, I served with a minority, and the majority co-chairs for a committee would introduce committee bills. If I was on the Finance Committee, it said Finance Committee. I was never asked. I usually didn't agree with the bills, but I never objected to them introducing a committee bill, and I knew I had the power to try and change it. The only difference this year is, for the first time in my legislative career, the co-chairs are asking permission to do what prior chairs always did without asking anybody. So they're being more transparent this year, and they're almost being accused of doing what's always been done in the past without any request whatsoever. And I just want to put on the record that on any committee I've ever served on, when I was in the minority, Representative Pruitt, Representative Wilson, I was never asked if the committee bill could be put forward. And here we have co-chairs asking, putting people on notice. I haven't seen the committee bill, and I may not agree with it totally, and I may try and amend it. I don't see it as something that I'm introducing. They're asking permission. But they're asking permission for something that has been done by the former majority forever. Thank you.
Is there further discussion? Representative Tilton.
Thank you, Co-Chair Seaton. I have to echo the sentiments of Representative Pruitt and Representative Wilson. I will say that when I was a committee chair, I did ask and did poll everyone on my committee and only did do a committee bill when it was okay with the majority of the committee, although I know that there is that ability for the chair to do, you know, bring forth a committee. I was always respectful of that whole committee process. I think our issues are too big, and regionally we're definitely divided in different thought processes, and I would just object to having a blanket endorsement.
Further comments? Representative Guttenberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The years I was in the minority, I think the number of times that I could remember being asked was probably on one hand, whether I wanted to be on a committee bill. I think it's recognized in the body and around the community that a committee bill doesn't necessarily represent everybody on the committee, nor does it represent that it's universally supported. We're going to go through an amendment process. Regardless of what it is, both here and on the floor, and the bill as it comes out will not be the bill that it finishes at. But I think having a committee motion to do that is more than I've seen before, and I respect that. Whether I agree with the bill or not, I think it's something that to be asked in the past would have been a nice thing to have done, but it was a rare occasion when it happened. Thank you.
Representative Thompson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, I object to a blanket authorization on that because there could be some bills that we absolutely don't agree that it should be a committee bill. It's going to be difficult to not be painted with a brush that we are all in favor of a committee bill, even though we might all, half of us or more, might object. I really feel like it should be as individual bill per bill should be talked about instead of just a blanket.
Is there further discussion? Objection is maintained, Representative Wilson?
Yes, Mr. Co-Chair.
Thank you. Would you, Secretary, call a roll?
Representative Guerra.
Yes.
Representative Gren.
Yes.
Representative Guttenberg.
Yes.
Representative Kawasaki. Representative Ortiz.
Yes.
Representative Pruitt.
No.
Representative Thompson.
No.
Representative Tilton.
No.
Representative Wilson.
No.
Representative Foster.
Yes.
Representative Seaton.
Yes.
6 yeas, 4 nays.
Thank you. With a vote of 6 in favor and 4 against, the motion is carried. Representative Foster, pass the gavel to you.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Co-Chair Seaton. At this time, I'd like to bring back HB 23 version O back before the committee. And this will be for the purposes of amendments. And I'd like to bring the sponsor's aide, Lisa Weisler and Joan Wilkerson from the Department of Law, to the table to help us through the amendments. If you could please come up. Now, the first set of amendments are technical amendments offered by myself as well as Representative Co-Chair Seaton. And so with that, Co-Chair Seaton, can I have a motion to bring amendment number 1 before the committee?
Mr. Chairman, I move amendment number 1, 30LS0258/0.16. before the committee?
Just for purpose of discussion.
Okay. And we've got an objection for purposes of discussion. Amendment number one changes the term health insurance to major medical insurance throughout the bill. The difference is major medical insurance is designed to cover a person during everything from routine checkups to major catastrophic events. Basic health insurance is a cash reimbursement service that can help pay for some but not all types of medical services. And does the sponsor's aide or Ms. Wilkerson have any comments concerning this amendment?
No, I think my name is Joan Wilkerson. I'm from the Department of Law. No, I don't have additional comments. I believe you've covered everything I would have said.
Okay, great. And we've got a question from Representative Wilson.
I just want to verify, Mr. Chairman. So is major medical what we call it now that versus a health insurance? This is just the name of it? Is that currently what we have is major medical for our employees and their spouses and family?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, active, it varies so widely depending upon which policy that you're talking about. The terms can vary very widely about what that means. Health insurance policy is generally how we refer to the active employee plan that is covered for all state employees through our self-insurance under Alaska Statute 3930091 at present. And major medical is usually how we refer to the retiree health benefit or medical plan.
And a follow-up?
Follow-up.
And so since you said it was within the retirees, that is where this would have normally taken place is when they retired, the type of plan. I'm just trying to figure out, is there a difference in cost, or is it just?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, the concept of just referring it, in various places it was referred to in the bill, I believe, as medical or health, and we're trying to come up with just one phrase to describe it. And the concept being that for all of the different types of health insurance policies that we could be looking at, what we're really zoning in on is coverage for those things that affect people the worst, and that is the need to go to the doctor, the need to go to the hospital, and that's major medical. And that's why we just came up with one phrase, and that's major medical.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I don't have an objection.
Great, thank you. We've got two more questions, one from Representative Seaton and then Thompson.
Thank you. Would either or both Medicaid and Medicare be considered major medical?
Co-Chair Seaton, that both Medicare and Medicaid would be considered major medical.
Thank you.
As would the retiree health benefit plan.
Thank you. Thank you. Representative Thompson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to make sure the bill states that they shall pay the premium for the level of health care coverage existing at the time of death. I want to make sure we aren't in possibly increasing the amount of coverage that a person would be eligible for by changing it to major medical. I mean, we've got it in the bill that they will be covered at the level at the time of death, and this isn't going to increase that coverage, is it?
Through the chair, Representative Thompson, the intention was simply to describe a type of plan and use it consistently throughout the bill. So the intention was not to change the level of care that they were receiving at the time of the employee's death.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair.
Okay, real good. The objection has been, we've got another question. Sorry, Representative Tilton.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. So these terms are defined in the statute, and I can find them.
I'm sorry. The terms you're referring to are major medical?
Yes.
I believe they are in version O. I think I saw them in an amendment. I believe they're in an amendment that's been offered.
Mm-hmm.
through the chair, Representative Tilton, I'm flipping through the amendments, and I could have sworn that I saw major medical defined in here, but I wasn't the author, and so I haven't been able to find it. I apologize. I'll continue to look.
Thank you. Are there any further questions of the committee? Seeing no questions, the objection from Representative Wilson has been removed. Are there any other objections? Seeing no objections, amendment number one is adopted. Okay, Co-Chair Seaton, can I have a motion to bring amendment number two before the committee?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move amendment number 230LS0258/0.24.
Object for purposes of discussion.
Okay, we've got an objection from Representative Guerra. For purposes of discussion, amendment number two clarifies that the money received by the department to pay the insurance premiums for state employees and the 50% for small municipalities shall be accounted for separately, and the appropriations for the insurance payments are made from the fund. And does the sponsor's aide or Ms. Wilkerson have any further discussion on this amendment? Sorry? If we could take a quick Eddie's. Okay, we're back on record, and so we're going to roll amendments, what I was calling amendment number 2, 0.24. We will roll that to the bottom of the pile here. We've got 13 amendments, so we'll roll that to the bottom. And Jane, if you're out there, if you could get the person who was going to be presenting that one available.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Seaton.
I'd like to withdraw the motion to approve the amendment so it's not still before us.
Okay, thank you. The motion to move the amendment has been withdrawn. We'll roll that to the bottom, and we'll move to what in your packet should be amendment number 3, which is 0.21. Co-Chair Seaton, can I have a motion to bring the amendment for the committee?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move amendment number 330.LS0258/0.21.
Object for purposes of discussion, please.
Okay. We've got an objection from Representative Guerra. And for purposes of discussion, now this amendment number 3, it clarifies the level of health insurance benefits that shall be maintained for the survivors, how the payments of the premium shall be made, and that the definitions of a small or large municipality shall be based on the latest figures of the United States Bureau of Census. Does the sponsor's aide or Ms. Wilkerson have anything to say about this amendment? And I see some head shaking, so no. And are there any questions of the committee? We've got a question from Representative Seaton.
Thank you. On page 1, down line 20, where we have definition of large community of 10,000 or more based on the latest figures of the United States Bureau of Census, I'm trying to figure out whether these payments, the population, if this is the population at the time of someone's demise, or whether it is would vary. In other words, if the population increases or decreases over the 10 or 15 or 20 years, does that mean that that goes, switches from 50% to 100% payment from large to small, or if population decreased, would it no longer be 100% from the municipality but only 50% from the municipality? And I don't see a clarification here as to whether when that designation is made and whether it changes over the life of the surviving spouse with the insurance being paid.
And I'd also like to note that we have with us Representative Kawasaki. Please proceed.
John Wilkerson, Department of Law, Co-Chair Seaton. This language has been presented through Ledge Legal, and I would, of course, defer to Dan Wayne to testify about it. I didn't insert this language. I'm unsure of how to answer your question.
And we do have Lisa Weisler.
Thank you. Lisa Weisler, Chief of Staff, Representative Josephson's office. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Seaton, I believe because of the way that this fund is set up, it is needs-based, and so there won't be any need for contribution or for a municipality to participate until the unfortunate happens. And so it would be at that time that the population would matter. So, you know.
And thank you for that clarification. However, what I'm wondering is the way it's written here, it doesn't say at the time of death, or it doesn't, it just says you're a small or a large municipality and your contribution rate, and it's not clear. I just, you know, however it's going to be is fine. I just want to very clear on the record that if you have 11,000 people and you're paying these benefits 100% of the municipality, and there's a decline in the population, so there's 9,000 people in that community, does it at that time when the population switches, does the contribution rate from the municipality drop to 50%? Or if in the reverse, if you were a small community of 9,000 and someone dies and you're paying the insurance premiums of 50%, and then the population increases to 12,000 or above 10,000, do you now have the responsibility for 100% of the premiums? And I just not sure it's clear as I'm reading it, but if the Department of Law has a clarification there as to the way it's written and what it means, that would be fine. I just want to make sure that we're clear exactly what the intent and the language is with the bill.
And Co-Chair Seaton, I think the answer to your question is well taken. It needs to be clarified. The language should be clarified, and the clarification would be a policy answer, I think, from this body of what you want that, when you want that $10,000 to apply, when that should kick in, at the time that the bill is passed or subsequently.
Okay, we've got two questions, one from Representative Guerra and then Pruitt, possibly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So the amendment, the intention, Ms. Weisler, is for that to be the population at the time of the employee's death. Is that correct?
Lisa Weisler, yes, that is correct.
Mr. Chair, I think if we did a conceptual amendment, if I could offer a conceptual amendment number one to amendment number three.
Okay, and go ahead and state your conceptual amendment.
I would offer conceptual amendment number one to amendment three at line 21, following the word more, and on page 2 at line 4, preceding the word according, insert the words at the time of the employee's death.
Okay, the conceptual amendment to the amendment is on the table. Are there any objections to the conceptual amendment? Seeing no objections, the amendment has been adopted, and so we're conceptual amendment, so we're back to the amendments. Further discussion on the amendment? We've got a question from Representative Pruitt and then Representative Ortiz.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And again, this, I don't know, this may be for person on the line, but I just want to make sure that I am reading it correctly and that I do understand that we are, other than, I think that the other than on the bottom pieces where we're trying to define 10,000 according to the latest figures, the rest of it, the kind of the bulk of it there that is deleting and inserting, we're still mandating that the municipalities participate. If I'm reading this right, is that correct?
Lisa Weisler, yes, that is, through the chair, that is correct.
Okay. So just to make sure I understand, the substantive change here, what really was the appropriate need for it? And mind you, I mean, I didn't have the, I just got this before we got in here, so I apologize that I'm asking the question now and not, and didn't understand this.
Thank you. Through the chair, Representative Pruitt, Lisa Weisler. This, I believe this was, must have been from legal services, and my understanding was it was just to clarify the section on the municipal mandate to make it clear in terms of the percentages. But Mr. Wayne may be a better one to answer why he felt necessary to spell that out that way. But certainly the intent is not to change the mandate.
Is it possible to ask him to?
Absolutely. Dan Wayne, he is the legal drafter. Dan, are you online?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I'm online. This is Dan Wayne from Legislative Legal Services.
Okay. If were you able to hear the question okay?
If you could restate the question, I'm not sure what it was.
Representative Pruitt?
Yeah, no problem. So I'm trying to understand exactly why the change was needed, and is there a substantive change that's being made? And if you'll answer that, and then I'll see if I have questions based on your response.
Mr. Chair, through the chair, if the question has to do with why the entire amendment was needed, the entire amendment was designed to clarify that municipalities are required to pay money and to clarify how much they're required to pay. And then to also clarify how much the commissioner shall pay from the fund.
Hello?
Okay. So when we specifically, of course, there's a new section created, 39.60.050, which specifically highlights municipal contribution, and it says that it should pay the premiums. You felt that that wasn't clear enough, that the municipalities would be paying and this does the job?
Through the chair, I drafted an amendment that to try to make it more clear.
All right, if it's just clarification, I'm fine. Thanks.
Okay, are there further questions on amendment number 3? And we have our representative.
Exactly the same as Pruitt, so thank you for asking.
Okay, we've got a objection still on the floor by Representative Guerra.
I withdraw my objection, Mr. Chair.
Okay, the objection's been withdrawn. Are there further objections on amendment number 2? Seeing no objections on amendment number 3, Representative Seaton.
And Mr. Chair, this amendment was as amended?
Correct, as amended with the conceptual amendment from Representative Guerra. Thank you for that. Okay, seeing no other objections, amendment number 3 is adopted. We'll move on to amendment number 4, if I can have an amendment motion from Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move amendment number 430 LS0258 /0.12.
Object for purposes of discussion.
Okay, we've got an objection from Representative Guerra. And for purposes of discussion, the amendment number 4, it clarifies that the surviving spouse becomes ineligible to receive major medical insurance coverage upon reaching Medicare eligible age rather than a set age of 65, since the qualifying age for Medicare may change. And does the sponsor's aide or Ms. Wilkerson have any anything to add to that? Seeing nothing from them, are there any questions from the committee? We have a question from Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. First is page 3, line 12, not 13. My question is, though, why do we need this amendment? I mean, it should be just to delete line 12, because in line 10 and 11, we already said becomes eligible to receive a major medical insurance coverage benefit by other means. It was my understanding from an amendment we passed earlier that Medicare is a major medical insurance. So as soon as they would, no matter what age they are, as soon as they were able to get Medicare, they would already be ineligible. So instead of an amendment deleting we should just delete line 12 because it's not necessary, because Medicare is a major medical. So can I amend the amendment?
You could certainly put in a conceptual amendment, and then we'll move to a question from Representative Guerra.
Well, the conceptual amendment would be to delete line 12, which at page 3, line 12, that says reaches 65 years of age. I think that's really the intent of what this amendment was trying to do.
Object.
We'll object to the conceptual amendment. We've got, can you speak to your objection?
Yeah.
Representative Guerra.
You know, I think we're all on the same page here, but in order to adopt Representative Wilson's amendment, we would all have to have the definition of major medical insurance in front of us. And right now, the amendment, the way it reads, amendment number 4, the way it reads, makes clear that once the person's eligible for Medicare, this benefit ends. Removing it doesn't make the language any clearer. Leaving it in makes it clear. Removing it may or may not have the same effect, but sitting here without the definition of major medical, I just don't know if the amendment does more harm than good.
I've got a question or statement from Representative Wilson.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I just asked the question whether Medicare, no, I didn't ask. I think somebody else here asked, and I think it was Representative Tilton, if that was a definition under Medicare, and we were told yes. So maybe we have a bigger problem here than this amendment is, if we're writing a bill on what major medical insurance is, then we need a definition of it. Because if the definition is Medicare or Medicaid or whatever else it is, and I mean that's the only reason I'm saying it, is because it says if you're eligible to receive anything else, and even from our discussion earlier, it was Medicare, or if I got married and my spouse had insurance. So now I guess I'm confused, because let's say I do get remarried and my spouse has insurance. Now if it's not major medical insurance, but it's health insurance, then we're still going to be covering those individuals because we changed this definition. And I don't think that was the intent. I thought the intent was to make sure that we're covering, you know, our employees. So earlier we said it matched. Now we're not sure whether it matches. Do we need a definition of major medical in the bill before it leaves this committee?
Got a question from Representative Kara.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As instead of number one, I think the amendment number four reads fine as it is. What you want to do is make sure that once somebody gets Medicare, this benefit doesn't continue. Everybody seems to be in agreement on that. We're quibbling over words. Amendment number four makes it clear. But I've now, as folks have been arguing over what major medical means, found the definition. I could read through it right now. But
I would appreciate it.
I don't want to. But amendment number four seems fine, so I don't really understand why we're debating this.
Representative Wilson.
Mr. Chairman, and I don't think we're debating. The debate is, and I guess it opens up a bigger thing for me, not necessarily just with this amendment now, because if by changing earlier from health to medical, major medical, and part of this bill also deals with, you know, and here, and this amendment actually does, because number one says, you know, becomes eligible to receive major medical coverage benefit, they will no longer be eligible for this pot. It was my understanding that Medicare was major medical, and therefore, as soon as you were able to get it, you would not be out of this pot anymore. Didn't matter what age you were, you might be 62 and a half and be able to have it. The concern I have now is, and I mean, you can put anything in there you want to, is back to if I were to get married and the person only have health insurance, which is what we changed it from before, that won't be good enough because it won't be the same level as what we've now changed it to major medical. And so I'm not trying to argue over definitions. But when we're going to base eligibility on what I have as insurance, and my spouse may have something that's not the same, then we're going to cover people for basically until they get to Medicare. Because it has to be to that level, major medical level, before we stop covering the individuals, even if they have some other type of health insurance that may be below this definition. I'm not an attorney, so maybe you know more than I do on this, and I just want to make sure that, I mean, this is big. People need to know what they're going to be covered underneath, and that's my only concern.
Representative Guerra.
Mr. Chair, for amendment number four, all we're debating is whether or not at the time somebody's eligible for Medicare, the state or municipality should continue paying for coverage that, frankly, won't be allowed because once you go into the Medicare system, it's Medicare. So unless there's debate over that, I think once Medicare kicks in and there's no need for the municipality or state to keep paying for the coverage. I guess I'm trying to find where the room for debate over this is.
So Mr. Chair, I will remove my amendment to the amendment. I just find it interesting that we're fine with it being a lower type of health insurance that's Medicare, but we'll discuss it as we get to the bill in itself, so I do remove my amendment to the amendment.
Thank you, Representative Wilson. The amendment to the amendment has been removed. The objection has been removed. Representative Thompson, did you still have a comment?
The objections have been removed, Mr. Chair. I won't discuss.
Thank you, Representative Thompson. Okay, so that brings us back to the amendment, which is amendment number 4.0.12, and it was mentioned that should read page 3, line 12, so we probably need a technical amendment.
Mr. Chair, I move a conceptual amendment, which on amendment number 4, so conceptual amendment number 1, on amendment number 4, line 1 of amendment number 4, should say page 3, line 12, not page 3, line 13. So that would be the conceptual amendment.
Is there any objection to that amendment, conceptual amendment?
It's actually amendment 2 because one was, although it was withdrawn, it was withdrawn. Still put there.
Okay. Okay, so conceptual amendment number 2 is on the floor, and this is to amendment number 4. And are there any objections to conceptual amendment number 2? Seeing no objections, conceptual amendment number 2 is adopted. And is there any objection to amendment number 4?
As amended.
Seeing no objection, amendment number 4 as adopted is amended. Thank you. Okay. Co-Chair Seaton, can I have a motion to bring amendment number 5 before the committee?
And Mr. Chairman, I'd move amendment number 5, 30LS0258/0.08.
Okay, thank you. We have an amendment on the floor. Is there any objection?
Object for purposes of discussion, Mr. Chair.
Okay, we've got a objection from Representative Guerra for purposes of discussion. Amendment number 5 moves the fund set up to the beginning of the bill for clarity. Does the sponsor's aide or Ms. Wilkerson have any comments on this amendment?
No.
There are no comments. Are there any comments from the committee? Okay. Seeing no comments, we do have a question from Representative Pruitt.
Not a comment. I just want to make it's just clarity myself. It's exactly why are we moving it? Does it change?
And Representative Pruitt, I've got Dan Wayne online. Dan, are you online?
Yes, I am.
If you could go ahead and explain in further detail this amendment. Thank you.
This is Dan Wayne from Legislative Legal, and I'm looking at the amendment number 5, and it's my understanding that the intention of this amendment was to just move the concept or the sentence from one place in the bill to another. So moving it from page 2, line 3 through 5, to page 1, line through 13.
Representative Pruitt?
Why?
Dan, if you could, do you know any reason as to why that move was made?
I don't know why the move was made. A lot of times, as you probably know, we draft amendments that were requested to draft. Sometimes even if we know a reason for something, we might not be able to tell you in response to a question like you've asked. But I think that the intention was just to move the sentence, and my assumption was that it had to do with style. And,
Thank you, Mr. Wayne. We've got a question from Representative Guerra and then Representative Kawasaki.
Mr. Wayne, the two sentences, even though they use different words, seem to say the same thing. Does the amendment have any impact on the meaning of the bill or the coverage in the bill?
I don't think so. When I redrafted it, of course, I had help from other people here at my office. We always try to make something better if we think we can, and I felt like that the language we were inserting back in that we took out on lines 3 through 5. Benefited from a little editing before we inserted it back in, and so that's why it looks a little bit different. But it's the meaning is the same.
Through the chair, Mr. Wayne. Okay. So the Legislegal decided that based on your drafting standards, the first sentence that we're inserting is cleaner than the second sentence, but they mean the same thing.
We always try to make language as clear as possible to the common understanding and avoid ambiguity. And we felt that this sentence was better than the sentence that we took out, maybe by only a small degree, but there you have it.
Hello? Okay, next up we've got Representative Kawasaki.
I think that clarifies my question. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Next up we've got Representative Guttenberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I appreciate the amendment. Many times we go through this process, and Representative Pruitt's question, I think, is very relevant. We go through the reading of the bill, and only farther down after we decide everything we're doing, we find out what actually the purpose is. So as far as legislative drafting, I always prefer to the purpose of establishing a fund be, in this bill, as close to the front as possible. That makes sense for me. what are we doing? We're establishing a fund. So moving it forward to delineate that makes sense to me, and I hope drafting continues that practice.
Very good. Thank you. Any other questions of the committee? Seeing no questions, we had a objection from Representative Guerra.
He removes his objection.
You withdraw. Okay. Very good. Thank you. Okay. The objection to Amendment Number 5 is removed. Are there any further objections? Seeing no further objections, Amendment Number 5 is adopted. Okay, Co-Chair Seaton, can I have a motion to bring Amendment Number 6 before the committee?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Move Amendment Number 6, 30LS0258/0.13.
Object.
Okay, we've got a objection from Representative Guerra. For purposes of discussion, this amendment redefines firefighter in this bill and was brought to us by the Department of Law. Ms. Wilkerson, can you explain to the committee why this is a better definition of firefighter for this bill?
Yes, my name is Joan Wilkerson from the Department of Law. The reason for adding the word year-round is the previous description explains that the person that we are looking at is a full-time permanent position, but there are, from what I understand, full-time permanent firefighter positions which are not year-round. They are seasonal, and they are still considered permanent and full-time because full-time means that they work over 30 hours a week, and permanent means that they return to the same position control number every year. But the issue was, well, who does this bill address? It addresses people who are receiving health benefits already and maintaining the status quo of those health benefits for the family. And so in order to describe that employee, it was necessary to explain that we're looking at someone who's employed year-round and therefore receiving health benefits year-round. Part of the issue is there could be a negative tax consequence if the benefit was applied and extended 12 months of health insurance benefits when the employee was only receiving 3 or 4 months worth of benefits.
Okay, are there any questions on amendments number 6? Got a question from Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So how many of those who are seasonal do we give full medical attention to? Do we offer full medical?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, I don't have the answer to that question. I would defer to risk management or perhaps the Division of Retirement and Benefits for the answer to that question. I don't have that.
Well, Mr. Chairman, it just seems this is a rough one because if somebody goes to a fire, I mean, it's kind of fire and whether or not that or a police officer, which is next, and you go into a dangerous situation and during a wildfire, which we found there is not a fund for, and you're killed during that fire, and you are, you know, getting major medical and you're employed by these areas, then it would seem like that they should be covered as well. But I'm really curious whether or not seasonal we provide all the same perks as we do for full-time. I'm just curious whether this is really an issue. I know what you're trying to get to where if they're only getting 3 months and then somebody does happen, then we're going to give somebody who had 3 months, you know, because it was during seasons, a 12-month benefit. But I thought also in the bill it talked about that we're going to give the same benefits as they left with. And wouldn't that take care of that issue?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, that one of the concerns that we were alarmed about was, as the bill is written, providing health benefits, premiums to pay for health benefits for the survivors of police and fire, it's an exception to some Internal Revenue Codes that concern paying taxes on additional benefits. But it is an exception to those rules because the Internal Revenue Code has through revenue rulings, chosen to see the survivors as stepping into the shoes of the employee. So in order to make the benefit as close to what the employee was receiving it's necessary to identify who we're talking about, who we're applying this to. If the person was employed 12 months a year, then the premium can be paid for their survivors for 12 months a year. But if we start including people who are only employed 3 or 4 months a year, we could be interfering with that necessary tax exemption.
Follow up, Mr. Chairman?
Follow up.
So although it says in the bill that they'll receive the same level of insurance that they left with, there's no way to make that provision if they're just there 3 or 4 months. There's only a way to make that provision if it's a 12-month policy.
I'm sorry, I don't understand the question.
Okay, so that we're concerned that we would have to give an employee who was only on medical for 3 months, and we'd have to give them 12 months because of the way the bill is. But I thought the bill stated that they would only get the same level and of insurance that they left with. So if you're only getting 3 or 4 months, then the maximum they could get, I would think, for the previous years would be 3 or 4 months.
I understand. Thank you for clarifying. Through the chair, Representative Wilson, the level of care refers to, for example, premium standard or economy plan. At least that was the concept in writing it. But if it's the will of this body to arrange the duration of the period of insurance, then I think that would need to be separately addressed. Because presently the bill only considers a 12-month a year health benefit.
Okay, thank you.
Medical benefit.
We've got two questions, one from Representative Guttenberg and then Guerra.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm trying to figure out where the line is drawn with and without the amendment, and whether or not whether it's intended or unintended, just some clarification, full-time by the state or year-round by the state. When you talk about wildland forest firefighters, those guys work sometimes 8 or 10 months a year. So is this meant to draw a line where they're not eligible for this under the definition of firefighter, where they would not be eligible for this if they were otherwise qualified for the benefit?
Through the chair, Representative Guttenberg, the intention of the amendment is to make it clear that the premium is paid if the employee was receiving it, then the premium is paid to the survivor. So the point of the amendment is to make clear that it would apply to year-round, in other words, a 12-month employee. Like I said, if it's the will of this body to adjust that, then that's possible, but it would take some restructuring, I think, of the bill.
Mr. Chair, I'm just concerned about what the facet of the process that she's talking about is just one of them. When you start talking about other kinds of forest fires who are basically year-round but only works 8 or 10 months a year, have a specific PCN that they come back to year after year. They might not work year-round, but they work full-time in a established position, whether they're being cut out of this intentionally or unintentionally. Her point is something else, but I'm concerned that we might have unintended consequences. And maybe we want to say that. I don't know, but I just like to understand what that actually is. Thank you.
Thank you. We've got a question from Representative Guerra.
Ms. Wilkerson, I think we're talking about a really small class of employees, but if you have a firefighter or a police officer who, on page 2, is a full-time employee of the state or a municipality, and they die in the line of service, what would be the harm of covering them even if they're full-time and aren't working year-round? So right now, the way the bill reads, the spouse and surviving dependents are covered if the person was full-time and was receiving employer-sponsored health care benefits. There's really an IRS problem if we provide survivors' benefits under this bill to those folks?
Well, through the chair, Representative Garth, that it's hard to answer a question in hypotheticals, as you can imagine. But the concern that we have is, again, putting the survivor in the shoes of the employee, putting them in the situation the employee was in at the time of death. And the concern is, if the employee was receiving benefits and employed full-time and receiving those benefits at the time of death, then the survivor would receive the same level of benefits during employment. If you wish to adjust the bill to make the benefit available on a less than 12-month basis.
I'm sorry, through the chair. That wasn't my question. My question is, somebody, I just want to understand your concern. I mean, apparently it's the Department of Law that brought this concern to us. So I just want to hear your concern for, and I'm happy to hear the discussion, but your concern is that somebody is full-time, they die in the line of duty, they have a surviving child or spouse, and your concern is that if they're not year-round, we should not cover them with a benefit in this bill. And I just want to hear just a logical explanation. I get that there may be one. I just want to, I'd like you to state it. I'm not saying, I don't agree with the idea that they should only get 3 months of benefits a year afterwards. So forget about that.
The concept, through the chair, Representative Garr, the concept is to take an employee who is receiving benefits and provide the benefits as if the employee continued to live to the survivor. If the employee was only employed 4 months a year, the survivor would not have expected the benefits for the remainder of the year through that employer. And so that's, if you wish to adjust the bill to make that happen, then I think that we need to rearrange it, to redraft it. But the concept, it comes from revenue rulings, as I said, that do not require the state or the employer or the recipient to be taxed on the value of those premiums. There has to be a nexus. It has to be similar to what the employee would have been receiving. And if they weren't receiving benefits 8 months of a year, then there could be a concern that we're going beyond what the IRC would allow.
Thanks.
So on this one, we can either proceed and either adopt it or not adopt it, or we can roll it to the bottom if members would like some more clarity and maybe getting some other folks on board. Is there looks like we've got one community member who's maybe wanting to roll it to the bottom. Is there? Let's go ahead and do that. We'll roll this amendment to the bottom here and take this up again later. It's amendment number 6. Co-chair, Representative Seaton.
Just to preserve order, I withdraw my motion to adopt amendment number 6 this time.
Thank you. Representative Seaton withdraws his amendment on amendment number 6. We'll roll that one to the bottom. Let's proceed down to amendment number 7. And Representative Seaton, if I could have an motion for amendment number 7.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move amendment number 730LSO258/0.14.
Object for purposes of discussion.
Okay, we've got an objection from Representative Guerra. And for the purposes of discussion on amendment number 7, this amendment redefines police officer in the bill and was brought to us by the Department of Law. Ms. Wilkerson, can you explain to the committee why this is a better definition of police officer for this bill as well? And it looks like it might be the same issue. Representative Seaton?
Mr. Chairman, we have a question.
Sure, Representative Pruitt.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. It's basically substantially the same discussion as the last one, so I think if we're going to roll the last one to the bottom, we might as well roll this one to the bottom so that we're having the same discussion on the, it's obviously the wording might be a little different, but I think the concept itself stays substantially the same, and so maybe it might be.
And I agree.
To roll it.
Representative Seaton?
Yeah. And Mr. Chairman, I'd withdraw at this time amendment number 7.
Okay, the motion to move amendment number 7 has been withdrawn. We will roll that one to the bottom as well. Let's move on to amendment number 8. And Co-Chair Seaton, if I could have a motion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move amendment number 830LS0258/O.4.
Object for discussion, although it's my amendment.
Thank you, Representative Wilson. And would you please speak to your amendment and explain your amendment?
I will. I'm used to moving my own, but that's okay. Basically, what this does is just, you know, it just puts a date 10 years after the employee's death. One of the things that we heard more than anything else is being able to have time to get back on their feet, to be able to, most people, may get a job, have others, as we talked about, Medicare or whatever else, but it just, you know, puts some limit of liability on the state and, at this point, the municipalities as well. And I remove my objection to my own amendment.
Okay.
I'll object, Mr. Chair.
I think you would.
Thank you. Representative Wilson has removed her objection. We have an objection from Representative Guerra. If you could speak to your objection.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The whole purpose of the bill is to give some benefit to surviving spouses and children when somebody dies in the line of duty, firefighters, public safety officers in this bill. You could have a spouse that has 5 very young children and, you know, ages 1 to 6, let's say, who is only able to work part-time at a job where they don't qualify for health insurance, and we don't know what health insurance is going to look like next year or the year after on the federal level. But they may have no health insurance 10 years later still. And the point of the bill is to provide health insurance when somebody doesn't have it, but not when the person finally obtains it. I think the 10-year period is arbitrary and could result in some surviving spouses of slain officers and slain firefighters losing all health coverage after 10 years, and that's not something I would support.
Thank you. We've got 2 questions, one from Representative Thompson and then Pruitt.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Just to comment on this, this does not stop the health insurance on the 5 children until they're 26 years of age. Is that not correct? They would still be covered. Representative Wilson.
Representative Wilson, if you could answer
Representative
that.
Representative Thompson, that's correct.
We've got a question from Representative Pruitt.
Yeah, no, more of a statement of support. You know, I think what our goal here, our goal is to help transition. I think that's really what we're after here. Our goal is to transition and help the widow or widower that's gone through this incredibly tragic situation be able to transition into dealing with life without their spouse. And from this, I took the where does the military fall on this? And they actually have a lot of it's very different. There's not one specific thing that you can learn. It, depending on where someone might have passed away, whether it was actually at war, whether it was locally, they've got different rules. But substantially, there is a certain time frame where that transition period does end. And I think that for, balancing the two things, balancing the taking care of the individuals, which is our goal here, the fiduciary duty of the state and ensuring that we're looking at the long-term fiscal. And then lastly, what we should be doing with any of these people is transitioning. I think a time frame, and it is 10 years, I don't know that that's a specific number that I could put at and say there's science behind 10 years. But the point is there's, I think, the transition period that we're allowing, I think, is appropriate. And I think we're still taking care of these individuals, which is our goal, while at the same time allowing that transition period to take place So I support this. I would encourage others to support this as well.
Thank you, Representative Pruitt. We've got a question from, let's see here, it looks like Representative Guttenberg and then Kawasaki.
Just an observation. You know, we all read our own values and our own situations into this, but in my family, it wasn't a transition. It was a permanent situation. And when my aunt and four cousins were left, that was it. There was nothing else. There was no transition to another job. Medicaid, you know, kicked in later years, but 10 years wouldn't have solved anything, wouldn't have helped anybody. So I'm going to oppose this amendment.
Thank you. Representative Kawasaki and then Grin.
Thank you. It's more not a question, but just more of a statement, I guess, that I appreciate the value of this coming forward and having the debate about an adequate transition time. But I don't want to be put in a place where we're deciding how much transition time a spouse of a deceased trooper or police officer or firefighter really needs. I think that as far as the context goes in here, once they become eligible for major medical, they're no longer something. It's not something that the state or the municipalities will have to encumber and have to pay for. I suspect that annually, when a person has to apply for this fund through the commissioner's office, that'll be heartache enough, and that people will move on and will have a transition time. But I don't feel comfortable putting a transition time within the context of this bill.
Representative Guerra.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I've heard the explanation. I sort of take this one just personally, not that I'm offended, but personally because I lived this experience. My father was killed when I was 6. My father was not a firefighter. He was not a police officer. He was a doctor. So by that definition, wouldn't have fit into this bill. But my mother, were she to have stayed in the United States, had jobs where she would not have gotten health insurance. And so this amendment would cut off health insurance for the surviving widow of a slain police officer or firefighter who, if they were my mother, would not have had health insurance. So I can't support the amendment. I'm not going to assume that a widow is a laggard or is trying not to get work or trying not to get health insurance 10 years later. This is a difficult circumstance, and I just don't see the arbitrary picking of this 10-year period to cut off health insurance for somebody who might not have it, whose spouse has been slain, as good policy. So I object.
Okay, do we have any further comments on this amendment? Seeing none, Representative Garrett, do you maintain your objection?
Yes.
Okay, the objection has been maintained. With that, we'll put it to a vote.
Representative Grin.
No.
Representative Guttenberg.
No.
Representative Kawasaki.
No.
Representative Ortiz.
No.
Representative Pruitt.
Yes.
Representative Thompson.
Yes.
Representative Tilton.
Yes.
Representative Wilson.
Yes.
Representative Guerra.
No.
Representative Seaton.
No.
Representative Foster.
No.
4 yeas, 7 nays.
Okay, with that, on a passage of 4 yeas, 7 nays, the amendment number 8 passes.
Fails.
Fails. Amendment number 8 fails.
First one.
All right. Representative Seaton, can I have a motion to bring amendment number 9 for the committee? And that is,
Chair,
Representative Guttenberg's bill.
I won't be moving this amendment at this time.
Okay. So with that, amendment number 9 has been withdrawn by Representative Guttenberg.
He said he was going to move it himself. He wasn't withdrawing.
Not offered at this time.
Okay. So it's not being offered by Representative Guttenberg. And with that, I assume there are no other folks who would like to move the amendment, assuming so. Let's see, we've got amendment number 10. Co-Chair Seaton, can I have a motion to bring amendment number 10 by Representative Kawasaki before the committee?
Move.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move amendment number 1030LS0258/O-19.
Okay. Are there any objections?
Object.
I object.
We're on amendment number 10.
Can we have an at ease, Mr. Chairman?
At ease. Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd withdraw the motion for amendment number 10.
Thank you. The motion for amendment number 10 has been withdrawn. Is there another motion for the amendment?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I move an amendment. It's amendment number 1030LS0258/O.23.
Object.
Okay, thank you. We've got an objection from Representative Wilson. Would you like to speak to your objection? Or if you could maybe...
Well, he might want to talk about...
Right, yeah. Representative Kawasaki, if you could maybe speak to your amendment. Thank you.
I'll speak to my objection, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Amendment number 10 looks lengthy. It's really the only change that's substantive. Is the way we define, rather than using definition of a police officer or a firefighter, we've incorporated the all-encompassing peace officer definition, which was in statute. So a peace officer is defined in statute, and that peace officer is an employee who is a peace officer, a chief of police, a regional public safety officer, a correctional superintendent, or a probation officer. This is language similar to the House Bill 4002 that passed the 29th legislature by every member in this body except for Representative Gren, who is not yet a member. This is, I think, corrects some unequal treatment amongst officers. There was recently the Department of Corrections came forward to show support for modifying the language to once again include correctional officers. Correctional officers do work a tough beat. The member from the Correctional Officers Association last week mentioned a prison riot that was occurring in the state of Delaware. Three days later, after the riot was done, there was a deceased correctional officer. I think if we want to make this bill complete, that correctional officers ought to be included along with police chiefs, police officers, regional public safety officers. That's why I've offered this amendment.
Okay, thank you. Are there any questions on amendment number 10? Representative Thompson?
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. I'm just curious, our fiscal notes do not include correctional officers, probation officers. I'm just curious as to what does this amount to financially, because it's not addressed in the present fiscal notes that are attached with the bill, and I'm kind of curious on that as to will this cost a heck of a lot more money or not. I'm curious.
Thank you. Representative Kawasaki?
To respond to the inquiry for Representative Thompson, I've got the list of work-related deaths within the state. There was an unrelated health reason death benefit in 1988, a person who had health complications and died in 1990. Another Department of Corrections officer who had an unrelated health reason that passed away in 1991. An auto accident that happened in 2002, and another officer-related health complication. That person passed away in 2013. None of these five, one, two, three, four, five Department of Corrections officers would qualify under the definition contained in the bill dealing with proximate cause and dealing with the fact that their injuries were not related to something that was sustained at work. There were no probation officers that were deceased as a result of work either.
Thank you. We got a question from Representative Seaton.
Thank you. And I'm trying to figure out the other categories that peace officers entails. I thought that's why the definition had been changed from peace officer to police, was to more closely categorize to the personnel we were trying to specifically cover, and I thought peace officer was a much broader term. It would include a number of different categories, not just correction officers.
Representative Kawasaki?
Sure. Just again, peace officers is defined in the legislation, and it's very specifically to address chiefs of police, regional public safety officers, correctional superintendents, or probation officers. So it's narrowed to that list. The only changes from the legislation O and this amendment, the only change that would be enacted if this passes is that chiefs of police would be included, correctional officers would be included, and correctional superintendents and probation officers would be included, essentially.
A question from Representative Guttenberg.
Thank you. I haven't seen the definition of a regional police safety officer. Do we know what that is? She's poised.
John Wilkerson from the Department of Law. Through the chair, Representative Guttenberg, I did some checking because I was unfamiliar with that expression. While it exists in statute, it's my understanding from the Department of Public Safety that that job classification no longer exists, and the duties have been subsumed by troopers.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So I'm going to assume the probation officers would include the juvenile justice probation officers as well as those for adult probation. And are parole officers not included in this definition?
Representative Kawasaki.
So the definition for peace officers, I do not believe includes parole officers, but would include both junior adult probation and juvenile probation under this definition.
And a follow-up?
Follow-up.
So it's my understanding that a probation officer and a parole officer, I mean, if we're going to talk about Dangerman, I would imagine it would be pretty close to the same. Does anybody know the distinction between the two? I know one, it depends upon what sentence they have, which one you go to, and but as far as their safety goes, is one safer than the other?
Representative Kawasaki? No.
Okay, thank you.
Any lifelines out there? Okay. Any further questions on the amendments? Seeing no further questions, are the objections maintained?
I remove my objection.
Okay. The objection from Representative Wilson has been maintained. Did we have any other objections that were out there? Hearing no objections, amendment number 10 has been adopted. Okay, moving on to amendment number 11. This looks like it's Representative Wilson's amendment. Representative Wilson, would you like to move your amendment?
I would. Mr. Chairman, I move amendment number 11.
Okay.
Object.
And
for purposes of discussion.
Objection by Representative Guerra. And Representative Wilson, if you could please explain amendment number 11.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. What this does is it basically allows municipalities to opt in. They're not forced to become part of a program. We have Sergeant Brandt from the City of Fairbanks. He is currently being covered by the City of Fairbanks at a level that they can be able to afford to, although I do appreciate the amendment that was put in here by the co-chair as far as distinguishing between a large and a small community, but even North Pole, that's a community of 2,000, you know, it should be up to them how they want to handle, whether they want to pay 50% or 100%, what they can afford to be able to do, or how, you know, what kind of medical they want to give, or maybe they even want to give more. I didn't check with the mayor of the city of Fairbanks to find out exactly what Sergeant Brandt was able to do, whether it's more or less than this bill is, but to put one more thing on the municipalities when they already have the option to do this should remain with them. We heard from Kathy Wasserman. She was very concerned about the cost and what this is going to do to them. I truly believe that each community will make the decision. They just may decide to do it in another way. They may ask for contributions from the community and pay it that direction. They may have enough money into their general funds. But for the state to put this out, and we really didn't get a lot of testimony one way or the other from the municipalities, but I think the way it came, they just probably wasn't prepared, and that's why we saw Ms. Wasserman testify on their behalf. But I'm always concerned when we're taking something the state decides to do and put it on our local communities when they already have a lot anyway.
Representative Gehr.
Thank you, Ms. Chair. Under this amendment, you could have somebody killed in the line of duty whose spouse and children would have no health insurance after the police officer or firefighter dies. The purpose of the bill is to make sure that that coverage is provided. I'm open to a discussion by the sponsor about how much a small community should have to pay, but I'm personally not open to a discussion about whether we cover spouses or dependents. I think they should be covered when their parent dies in the line of duty as a firefighter or as a police officer. So on that part, I can't agree to this amendment.
Further questions of the committee? Representative Wilson.
Mr. Chairman, and I appreciate that, but you know, we're not covering everybody. I have service area firefighters, some of them that are here, you know, in the Capitol today. They're not going to be covered underneath this. I would hope that our borough would look at those just because we didn't mandate or didn't. At some point, we should give the option to our municipalities to determine how they want to handle their employees. And thus far, I don't know of any community that's not taking care of their own. And I think they will even take care of those that aren't even in this bill, no matter how this bill, you know, ends up. But to be able to put another stress on our communities or tell them how they have to do it, it's wrong of us. That should be up to the communities, and thus far, like I said, we have one that does it. I would imagine that we would see others, if they weren't even covered underneath here, would do the right thing and make sure that they take care of their own. So with that, I ask for your support.
Okay, are there further questions of the committee? Okay, Representative Gehr, do you maintain your objection?
Yes.
Okay. The objection's maintained. Okay. And can the Secretary please call the roll?
Representative Guttenberg.
Yes. Sorry. No.
Representative Kawasaki.
No.
Representative Ortiz.
No.
Representative Pruitt.
Yes.
Representative Thompson.
Yes.
Representative Tilton.
Yes.
Representative Wilson.
Yes.
Representative Guerra.
No.
Representative Gren.
No.
Representative Foster.
No.
Representative Seaton.
No.
4 yeas, 7 nays.
Okay, thank you. On a vote of 4 yeas and 7 nays, Amendment 11 fails. Okay, moving on to Amendment number 12. This is an amendment by Representative Wilson.
Mr. Chairman, I move amendment number 12.
Object.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, you know, third try.
And just for clarification, this is a movement of amendment 0.2, correct?
Yes.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
And so we have an objection from Representative Guerra and Representative Wilson. If you could explain amendment number 12.
So I received a lot of emails from Fish and Wildlife, from DOT, from others that are state workers, and saying how can you, they all respect firefighters and police officers. and everybody around this table does. Bills like this sometimes get taken out of context, but there is, we appreciate the hard work that is done. But if we're wanting to make sure that we're protecting state employees that are killed in the line of duty, and that may be a flagger that's standing next to a road and somebody comes and doesn't slow down, we see all the signs and hit them. Or if you've got a wildlife trooper, well, wild trooper would be there, but I had an aide who works for Fish and Game, and she worked out in the middle of nowhere in Kodiak, and something were to happen to her while she was there, is her life any less important? I don't think anybody here would say that. I know we've talked a lot about cost, and I would hope before this bill goes out, or even if it goes out, on which day, we don't have to pay this within the general fund. I personally would be happy to give so much a month and check a box on my paycheck and put into this fund so that our municipalities don't have to do it, or the general fund doesn't have to do it. There's a lot of state employees, and I truly believe a lot of them would have no problem making sure that if somebody out there doing their job got killed doing it, should be covered. And that really is why I brought this amendment forward, because I don't think I should pick winners or losers, and that's kind of what we're doing here today. And we're already doing it because we're only talking about those in the PERS system. And just so you know, for in our community, so it does cover, you know, the university fire, but yet it doesn't count. North Star Fire is my fire department. It doesn't cover them. They both could go into the same fire and both tragically, hopefully would never happen, be killed in line of duty. And one right now in this bill, we're covering one and we're not covering the other. So that is something that would need to be taken care of another day, much bigger issue. But for today, for our state workers, I appreciate each and every one of them for what they do when they get up in the morning or whenever they go into work and take it and do it. I can't tell them that their life is less important than anyone else's. And so this is my attempt to say, yes, I know this will cost more, but I think that we're pretty smart people around this table and can come up with other ways besides using general funds to be able to pay these. I know Representative Kawasaki had, at least on the corrections portion, how many had been killed in the line of duty. I don't think it's a huge number if we use a whole amount, thank goodness, but this amendment really is about, do you think you should pick the winners or losers, or whether or not everybody's life is important no matter what part of the government they work in?
Thank you. We do have a handout on the definition of major medical. I don't think everybody's gotten a copy. If not, oh, it looks like we have. Okay, I just want to make sure everybody's gotten a copy, and if not, we'll get that to you if you don't have one. Okay, so is there any further discussion on Representative Wilson's amendments number 12? We've got two questions, one from Representative Seaton and then Kawasaki.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I wanted to ask the Department of Law if expanding this out into all these different statutes, if that becomes a PERS issue.
John Wilkerson, Department of Law, through the chair, co-chair Seaton. The placing the benefit in Alaska Statute 3930090, that's what's referred to as the political subdivision plan. The amendment, as I read it, would include 090 as well as this, the state's self-funded plan, which is under 3930091, which is both active employee plan and the retiree plan. And in that sense, it would impact the retiree system because PERS and TERS retirees they obtain their insurance through the retiree system through 3930091. And 3930095 is the trust that holds on to the money. So this would touch on all of those statutes, and therefore it would have an impact on retirees. More, we are concerned about the impact because it involves, it extends premium payments to all state employees through 3930090 via eligibility under the PERS Occupational Disability Death Benefit, apparently. And so this amendment would apply to PERS members who qualify for the Occupational Disability Death Benefit, not just state employees or police officers and firefighters. The problem being that 393090, it covers state employees except those that have been exempted by regulation, as the state troopers already have. So they would not be covered under this, because they're not, they don't fall under 393090 currently.
Follow up.
Thank you. When we are passing something that that affects PERS benefits, do we have to have an actuarial fiscal note in addition, or instead of the regular fiscal notes we have?
Yes, under Alaska Statute 24.08.036, before a bill having an effect on a retirement system is reported to the Rules Committee, it must have an actuarial analysis and a fiscal note.
Follow up.
So if we would adopt this amendment as it is anyway, the bill could not go to the rules until there was an actuarial fiscal note, and therefore, do you have any estimate of what the cost of an actuarial fiscal note on the PERS system is to include these benefits?
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Wilson?
I've had a discussion with Dan Wayne. This does not open up the PERS insurers. The PERS insurers mentioned in here is if you were qualifying whether or not you were killed in the line of duty. It does not open up the PERS insurers. But I just had this discussion with Mr. Wayne, and I'd like him, because I'm getting this definition here is completely different than what I was told by the drafter. So if we can make sure that we have on record what this amendment does, it does not open up the PERS insurers. I called to make sure that did not happen, because that was not my intent. So if he's online, if he could explain the amendment to what it does, because that is not what he told me earlier.
If we've got a follow-up from Representative Seaton, and if not, then we'll go to Dan. Okay. Okay. Dan, are you on the line?
Yes, I am, Mr. Chairman. This is Dan Wayne from Legislative Legal.
Please proceed.
I heard the comments and the question. It's my opinion that that the way this is drafted, it doesn't have any impact on PERS at all, because all it does is it just cross-references some sections that are in PERS that under which a survivor of an employee who dies in the line of duty can qualify for a survivor pension benefit, not a medical benefit, but a pension benefit. So a test to determine whether or not they qualify for this pension benefit after the death of their spouse or their parent is already being done under those statutes and PERS. And so keeping in mind the notion of economizing and also effort, and also avoiding a situation where you have two separate tests, one test being done for pension benefits under PERS and another test, line of duty death test, being done under a statute for qualifying for extended medical benefits. It seemed to me like putting it, relying on that single test, which is already being done anyway, wouldn't cost any extra money, would actually save money, was one possible approach. The other thing is on page 4, line 2, just underneath where it's of the amendment, just underneath where it cites those two sections from PERS, it uses the term eligible for employee coverage. So it doesn't make the person eligible for coverage under PERS. It makes them eligible for employee coverage under the policy of group insurance under this subsection, AS 3930091 or 3930095. Now, it's my understanding that AS 3930, 090, 091, and 095 are the three sections under which all of the state employee coverage is authorized and obtained, including the coverage under self-insurance plans that are obtained by the union representing state troopers. So, if I can give you a hypothetical for just a moment, if a trooper were to die on the job, and this was law,
then the insurance that the trooper was getting as an employee would simply keep going. And it would be, as long as the death was in the line of duty, as determined under the test already being conducted by the Department of Administration to determine whether the survivors get a pension, as long as the death qualifies under that test, then the employee coverage would just simply just continue on. And so that's what it's designed to do. And I really can't see any way that it affects PERS whatsoever. And it even has a sentence at the end on page 4, lines 4 through 5. It says, this paragraph does not apply to a surviving spouse who's eligible for Medicare. Because as some of you may know, when a person becomes eligible for Medicare under PERS, they have to switch over to Medicare. And PERS becomes secondary. So that's what this first part of this does. And of course, Section 2 says that the Commissioner of Administration shall set the rate of employer contribution at 100%. In other words, they'll pay the entire premium of the continued employee coverage that's covering the survivors.
Okay. Any further questions on that? I think we had a... No, okay. Okay, with that, looks like we were working on Amendment Number 12, and question on PERS has been answered. Are there any further questions? See no questions. We have a question from Representative Thompson.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. I'm just curious. This is all state employees, so basically my staff... might be a disgruntled constituent come into the building and off them, or how about a school teacher that have a disgruntled parent that might come in? Are those included in this? I'm just kind of making sure here.
Mr. Chairman, through the chair, Representative Thompson, if someone disliked your staff that well, yes, they are a state employee. Teachers are not state employees unless you were to talk. I don't think Mount Edgecombe's counted as that either. Teachers are underneath the municipalities. They are not state employees. But, yes, your staff is counted as a state employee.
Okay. Any further questions? Seeing no questions, Representative Guerra, is your objection maintained?
Yes.
Okay. The objection has been maintained. Madam Secretary, can you call the roll?
Representative Kawasaki.
No.
Representative Ortiz.
No.
Representative Pruitt.
Yes.
Representative Thompson.
No.
Representative Tilton.
Yes.
Representative Wilson.
Yes.
Representative Guerra.
No.
Representative Gren.
No.
Representative Guttenberg.
No.
Representative Seaton.
No.
Representative Foster.
No.
3 yeas, 8 nays.
Okay, and on a vote of 3 yeas and 8 nays, Amendment Number 12 fails. Moving along to Amendment Number 13. This is an amendment by Representative Guttenberg. Can I have a motion?
Mr. Chair, I move Amendment Number 1330-LS0258/00-20.
Thank you. Are there any objections?
Object for discussion.
Objection by Representative Wilson for objection or discussion purposes. And I just want to also note that here to also help explain if needed, we do have David Teal available for questions. So with that, Representative Guttenberg, could you please explain Amendment Number 13?
Thank you. The way the bill works now is we set up a fund, and then when, let's take Juno, a Juno police officer dies, Juno pays a premium into the fund pays the deceased. What this does is it, the fund is still set up, but the commissioner or the designee will determine how much the fund is liable for and divide that between all the eligible employees, and the state will pay by the head and the municipalities will pay by the head into the fund. And if, and on a yearly basis, the fund will be capitalized on what is needed. If nobody dies, there won't be any additional funds being required until something happens. So it's more like a larger trust. It's more like a standard way of doing things instead of the way the bill is currently set up. So the liability, you wouldn't be paying premiums. Everybody would be paying an assessment on what it costs to keep the fund going. So if there's no deaths in the state, the premiums won't go up. They'll probably drop. So it's spreading the risk across all the eligible employees for the state and the municipalities.
Okay, we've got a question from three questions, Representative Ortiz, Thompson, and then Seaton.
Representative Guttenberg, would the effect of your amendment have any impact on the potential burden to municipalities? If the amendment was adopted, would it lessen the burden to potential burden to municipalities?
My impression, it would lower the burden on municipalities quite a bit.
Thank you, Representative Thompson.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. I'm a little confused. It sounds to me like it would increase the cost to the municipalities. I assume that this is a fund that is going to be similar to the higher education fund that could be actually stripped and used by us in the future. I mean, I'm concerned about that. We can't dedicate funds, but this would be a designation, and I can see where this could possibly be used as a slush fund in the future. What's the cap on where we needing to collect anymore? Is there a cap on this that we get $10 million in there? That's enough to cover it. We don't collect it anymore from the municipality. I didn't quite follow this through and to see where that fits.
Representative Guttenberg.
If I may, the commissioner or whoever's managing the fund, it's in the bill, will determine what the liability for the fund is. And it sets an eligibility contribution rate. There's no intention of building up a fund beyond what's needed. There'll be they'll set a rate as if a certain number of employees will die in a certain period, and then if none do, then the contribution rate will go probably to zero until there's a liability needed into the fund. So you're spreading the liability across the entire spectrum of employees, whether they're troopers or correctional officers or firefighters. It's spread across the entire spectrum, and there's no reason why it will become a fund larger than is needed for, say, 5 years, and then it would stop, or 3 years, and then it would stop. And if nobody dies, the fund just sits there. It doesn't continually grow. It sets a place where the actuarial say it needs to be. If nobody dies, there's no contribution. If we have a severe accident and there's a couple of people die, then the rate might go up in a year or two to cover that. But we're not paying premiums here. Paying premiums, the municipality paying premiums is, for me, is an awkward way of doing it. Let's spread the liability across all of the employees for all the state and drive it down so it's manageable, certainly for the municipalities. But instead of paying premiums, we're just paying an assessment based upon what is the liability is foreseen.
Mr. Chair.
Okay. Is that a follow-up on that?
Well, I think I want to ask a question in terms of making sure I understand it.
Okay. Representative Pruitt.
So if I understand it correctly, the $56,000 that the fiscal note states, the request is that every state employee would pay the equivalent of probably a little bit less than 50 cents a year to fund that particular, well, no, 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 sorry. It'd be a little under $2 a year, sorry. $2 a year to go into that fund. Is that a correct statement? And if someone were to pass, then it would go up. But as of right now.
The calculation would be something like that, yes. Not based upon the liability of the fund divided by all the eligible employees. And if somebody else died, it would go up that increment.
Can I follow up? So can I answer that? So that actually, what you just said is a very different statement, and I want to make sure that there's a clear distinction. The eligible employees, which now means peace officers or firefighters, or is your intent that all state employees are participants in investing in this?
Just thing? Eligible employees to receive the benefit.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. That's a really key piece because we just turned down covering fish and game and covering DOT, and even though it's $2, if that's a benefit they're not receiving, I would be very adverse to placing that burden on them. But if your request, and actually I think there's validity in that, is that just the peace officers and the firemen participate in the discussion of something that they could participate in, that might be.
I take the same position.
That takes a little of pressure. That actually takes the $56,000 out of the general fund, and if I'm the pressure on the general fund because it places it then back on the potential beneficiaries. And correct, I want to correct me if I'm wrong on that.
Yes, it is. Thank you, Mr. Chair. It is still the state and the municipalities. The number that I'm talking about is the number of employees that are eligible for the program. The state and the municipalities pay a percentage based upon what that number is. So it's if it's 56,000, it's divided between all of those the number of those employees eligible, and that's assessed to the state and to the municipalities.
Representative Pruitt?
Yeah, no, okay, sorry. So it's not resting on the employees to pay the $2. What the heck is the change?
The change is you're not paying premiums. You're spreading the potential liability across the entire state of eligible employees. So right now, let's go back to early last summer. Officer Brandt shot and killed. The simplification, but he shot and killed. The city is paying those premiums. If this was in place the way the amendment is written, they wouldn't be paying any more for Officer Brandt. That liability, that $56,000 or whatever it is, would be paying by every municipality and the state divided by the number of state employees and municipal employees that are eligible to receive the benefit.
Mr. Chair, I think I understand now, and I think I actually it's in a different direction. We're actually going to mandate the municipalities that may not have someone that's participating in it are now going to have to pay to facilitate this, as opposed to they would only be paying the premiums if they had someone that was participating in the program. So it's a shift in policy from what the way the bill was written. That let's say that. Ketchikan, for example, if they haven't had someone who's passed away there through this, no matter what, they'll participate. But the way the bill is written currently before this amendment, they would only participate if someone were to have passed away. So this is kind of back to that putting a burden on the municipalities, hence to the conversation with Cassie Wasserman. Her concern was that we were going to potentially put things. This kind of actually does it no matter what, even if they haven't had someone that's passed. Is it now my understanding what your amendment is doing?
Yes. It shares, Mr. Chair, thank you. I'm sorry. Mr. Chair, yes, it shares the risk across the state, and it should decrease everybody's liability a considerable amount, and it's more like buying insurance for this policy than anything else, than just simply paying premiums if it happens to your city or community.
Okay, we've got a question from Representative Seaton and then Representative Wilson.
thing, Mr. Chairman, and I'm trying to understand the structure of the amendment on line 8. It says, insert, set an eligible participant contribution rate based on the payroll for the persons who are eligible, and under 040, but it seems to me that we're talking about the eligibility is for the for a spouse who doesn't have a payroll.
Well, I'll call up my lifeline if David Teal is here under the structure of the bill.
Thank you, David. If you could put your name on the record.
Thank you. David Teal, Director of Legislative Finance Division. And I wasn't involved in determining coverage. I was asked simply to look at the method of paying or funding this. Basically, you have two methods that can be used. One is that you pay premiums only if an employee is killed in the line of duty. And the if you do that, that makes it so that, for instance, the city of Fairbanks would pay nothing until an employee is killed in the line of duty, at which time they would pay the full health insurance premiums. This moves away from that method because under that method, you're looking at a heavy burden to a small community like Hoonah, who has a couple officers killed in the line of duty. And that's a big burden for a small community to pay. So rather than take that large risk, the alternative method of funding would be, as Representative Guttenberg says, essentially a small contribution based on payroll. You'd collect the same amount of money, but you would collect it from everybody regardless of who the employee worked for. The advantage of doing that is that not just that it spreads the risk, but that it's a much safer way of funding the program in the sense that you now say you shall participate. And let's just move away from municipalities and everything else and just stick with troopers. I think it's easier. Right now it says you shall pay health insurance premiums for surviving dependents. Okay. As you know, any time it says shall for something like this, that's shall subject to appropriation pay these premiums because you cannot bind future legislatures to make that appropriation for future benefits. So every year there would have to be language in the bill asking for an appropriation to fill this fund. The alternative is to use it like retirement of the working reserve fund, where money is appropriated to the Department of Public Safety. It's in their base. It's a salary adjustment. If the rate changes, it goes up automatically in the base. So you don't have to worry about future funding. It's there. DPS always will have the money. Department of Public Safety will have the money. And by contributing that percent to payroll, it's going to be the same $56,000 that's needed. If someone else is killed in the line of duty, there's an automatic salary adjustment that would go in the budget to cover that. So it gets it away from the annual appropriations for this. It also spreads the risk. So I think that it does sort of impact eligibility in an indirect way, but that's because it becomes very easy to extend the eligibility to others. Basically, if the employer chooses to contribute, then those employees are covered. It wouldn't really matter whether it's police, fire, opinion, all workers. If the employer opts to cover them, you simply pay the rate, it goes into the fund, and then the spouses of those workers would be covered. If you can leave it optional. I mean, I didn't work on who would be covered, simply a safer method of funding the existing troopers.
Okay. We've got some members that need to get to their 3:30 committee meetings, and I think there's some questions on this as well as a few other things that I think will give some folks some time to look at that. We can let people kind of absorb this, and then we can go from there. So I think what we're going to do is we'll go ahead and adjourn until tomorrow, and then we could take this back up where we left off. So with that, our next meeting is scheduled for tomorrow at 1:30. After we get done with these amendments on this bill, then we will have a presentation by Devin Mitchell, Executive Director of the Alaska Municipal Bond Bank Authority, titled State Debt Affordability Analysis. And with that, we'll be adjourned at 3:29 p.m. Thank you.